Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Dom Giordano on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Hey, welcome in, everyone. The fourth in our virtual speaker series with America's favorite summertime guy. He comes in, creates a big stir, thrills us, and then goes back and creates another stir the next year round. Brad Thor, the first time we've had you now virtually. Welcome to Philadelphia again. And it seems like you are in some kind of futuristic space there, a man cave. Is that where you do your writing?
Yeah, it's my office. In fact, I had my son help me out. Behind me, that used to be the conference room, and we have a TV on the wall, and there's a fireplace in there, and we never used either of them. And so I said to my son, help me flip the furniture around, and it's just before the pandemic, so it just kind of became a cool background to have in all the shots.
Well, Brad Thor is with us again, three times in person now due to the pandemic. Brad's with us virtually. Thanks to Mal Mud Law again for bringing a speaker series virtually. And Brad, the brand new book took off. I mean, does it happen many times, even for someone at your level, that right out of the box, it's a number one New York Times bestseller? That's pretty special, is it not?
It is, and it's a testament to the readers that I've built up over the years because they all want the book that first week. So it's great. Near Dark's been out 2 weeks now, debuted at number one in the New York Times list. They normally let you know 2 weeks in advance of it ending up in the paper. Wall Street Journal, number one. Publishers Weekly, number one. I took second spot on the USA Today list. It's 150 of all the books, not just fiction, nonfiction. So there was a nonfiction book above me. It's just been a huge response. So everybody is loving this one, and that's music to an author's ears.
Exactly. Brad pleases the customers. Now, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to talk with Brad, but I'm going to intersperse. And when we've done this in person, it's very hard to get enough questions in. But virtually, we can do that. So if you have a question, just let us hear from you, type it in, and I will move them around and hit Brad with as many as we possibly can. Brad, I read about 7 or 8 reviews of the book and my wife's review of the book, which is the all-important one, of course. And retribution, one person really jumped forward to say, this is the special word. This is the thing that we're going to see in Near Dark. Is that it, retribution?
It is to a certain degree. And I think I probably should set the table a little bit for everyone watching. If you've been to one of the events that Dom and I have done together in person before, you know this. But in case this is your first time hearing me speak with Dom, I tell everybody that my novels are like the James Bond movies, that they have a recurring protagonist, but you don't need to have ever seen a James Bond movie before going in and seeing the latest one. So that's number one about the books. And to keep up that theme of movies, if Near Dark was a movie and Dom, you and I were going to go to the multiplex and see it, the movie poster would say $100 million bounty has just been put on the head of America's top spy. And that'd tell you everything there is about this book. So retribution is a theme in here. Darkness really is a theme. That's why the book's called Near Dark. The protagonist, Scott Harvath, is at an absolute low point personally, professionally, doesn't know if he wants to go on with his career, much less with his life. The book opens with him down in Key West, drinking in a very seedy dive bar down there. Key West has one or two. They have some nice ones as well.
Well, wait a minute. How much research did Brad Thor have to do for dive bars in Key West?
I was
did
in
you
Key
actually
West?
Go there to the
yeah.
dive bars? Yes,
last
you did.
Year. Yeah, I did. So I didn't drag. I took the family with me down to Key West, but I did not take them along to some of these bars. So It was interesting. I'd never been to Key West before. And I like to get, I went to Norway as well, doing research for this book. So I like to get to the places if I can. And if I can't, then I want to talk to somebody whose life has depended on noticing the details. So somebody in the special operations community, somebody at the CIA, that kind of a thing. But I'm steering away from your retribution question. Retribution is huge. Retribution is being visited upon Scott Harvath, my protagonist, for everything that he's ever done in the past. And he is also meting out his own type of retribution on people that have wronged him. So there's, like I said, darkness is a theme that plays throughout the book. And a lot of these men and women that we ask to go do these really dangerous jobs, it's difficult to kind of cup your hands around that inner flame of humanity and protect it from being extinguished. You see so many terrible things. And that's a thing. I mean, it's a thriller. This is supposed to be toes in the sand, book in the hand kind of a thing. But there are some of these interesting themes.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Why do you then, with a thriller, put so much work in, and we're going to talk about all those details and all that. You must have, you know your audience better than anybody. You must have an audience that's not enough. They need this elevated. They have to come out of this, and they've learned something in great detail.
Well, I think it's part of my makeup. I grew up in Chicago. My dad is a no longer active Marine. My mom had been a flight attendant for TWA in the 60s, and they were both entrepreneurs. And they both told me, never take your customers for granted. And every day that you show up on the job should be like your first day. And never forget that it can be your last. So always try to give your customers something better. And in fact, customer is not even the word that I use for my readers. I tell people, Dom, that I don't work for the publisher. I work for the readers. They're my bosses. And when they go to Goodreads or Amazon or Barnes & Noble and leave those 5 stars, that's my annual performance review. And I want them to be happy. So I'm always trying to weave interesting things into the books. Elmore Leonard once said to young writers that the best piece of advice he could give them is leave out the parts that people skip. So that's the balancing act when you do write these books. I find a lot of cool information during the year, and I'll get needled by friends at the CIA and things like that who say, wait a second, Thor, your character would have to talk to 8 people before he got to this one person he needed. And I say, yeah, but guys, I'm not writing a training manual that you can use for new intelligence officers. Nobody's going to sit through me describing 8 meetings. That's that whole balance of leave out the parts people skip. Like Clancy's a great example. My parents love Clancy. I love Clancy. And I used to steal their books. They read Clancy, Ludlum, Le Carre, Freddie Forsyth. And the minute my parents would set down a book, I'd grab it. I probably started reading those books at too young an age. But a lot of the tech stuff with Clancy was the stuff that I would whip through. Okay, I can see he's going to talk for X amount of paragraphs about how a guidance system on a missile works. And that, my dad's joke was that he was sure Clancy got paid by the word because the descriptions of some of these things were so long. So I heard that from my dad, and I think I internalized that with how I do my own details and how I choose to leave certain things out.
Let's go back. When you said $100 million, let's talk about how you formulate that as just the world's greatest bounty. I mean, why not 10 million, 20? How did you come up with that? Just sit there and say, oh, let's make it 100 million. Doesn't strike me that Brad Thor does that. You talked to someone, you went back and forth over it.
Yeah, I did. The 100 million has to be significant on several levels. It's got to create enough jeopardy for the main character. You've got to believe that this 100 million is going to attract the best assassins that are out there that are going to come after him. It also has to be significant for the person who places the bounty. Why the 100 million? So the 100 million is important in and of itself, just for the sake of the assassins it attracts, but it also is important for the amount of money that the person who is trying to get Scott Harvath killed, why the person or persons puts that bounty down. So I did a little research. The most interesting thing about that particular piece of it, Dom, is I talked to some of my people in my network who are out there doing some of the nation's most dangerous business. And I said to one guy who's like hyper aggressive, hyper smart, I said, what would you do if there was a $100 million bounty on your head? Would you go to ground and wait till the person? And he said, Brad, you're looking at this all wrong. He said, I wouldn't, and your character wouldn't. He said, you don't understand. This is a cat and mouse. Nobody turns me into the mouse. I am always the cat. He said, even if somebody puts $100 billion bounty on my head, I'm still going to be the cat. He said, I'm going to reverse engineer this whole thing. I'm going to turn the person or persons who put the bounty on me into the mice, and then I'm going to hunt them, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to stop until I put every single one of them in the ground. And I was like, whoa,
and that on our seems side. To me that's part of your genius, you know, and that's what we do in talk radio, and I know how much you like it, and you listen, and you're on, that you hear that, and you know right there, that's the capsule of the book. You said the same mm-hmm. exact thing to me when we had you on the show in Philadelphia. Right there, you come walking out. Do you tell your wife or somebody else? That's it. You write it down. And I can tell you're not budging off that. You know what it is. And then the rest is your storytelling coming in and whatever the new things you're doing. But you know that's the nugget for people that they're getting out of this. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't tell anybody, to be honest with you. Okay. I keep that. David Morrell, who's a great thriller writer, and his book was Rambo. He wrote Rambo, wrote a ton of great books, but Rambo with the Sly Stallone movies and everything, that's David Morrell. And David was a creative writing teacher, and he wrote a fabulous book about writing. And what he talks about is, he said, when you get that capsule or that nugget, that idea, he said, you cannot share it with anyone. He said, that thing has to propel you through the year or year and a half that you are writing your book.
You don't tell anybody during that period of time?
Not the nugget. You may tell them.
Wait a minute.
I may tell my editor or my agent. Okay. But the problem with telling that idea, it's like baby names. We realized very quickly early on, my wife and I, that when we knew that she was pregnant and it was safe to tell people, that if we told anyone the baby name we were thinking about, they invariably had an ex-boyfriend with that name that did them wrong. And, you know, it would take the wind out of your sails. So David Morrell is really serious about, don't share the idea with anybody, because that's your rocket fuel that you have to stay excited about. And if you give little pieces of it away by giving it to people, you lose your steam.
You are a man of mystery. That is really, now we had two questions in already. They wanted to know, which one do we go first with? You decide. Brad Thor's favorite writer currently, or why do I look so tan? I think the thing is, sure, that's my nugget for tomorrow. We're going to be talking about this from this thing tonight. People are, we tried all kinds of colorations. I don't know what they're doing. Can we make Brad a little bit tanner there?
Tanner. You know what? I did a fun thing over the weekend. I decided that I was going to pretend like I was in Italy for the weekend. Okay? So I laid out. I had some, what do we have? Like Spumante or something, you know, Prosecco. We had Prosecco. So Prosecco and prosciutto, and so it was Italian food, and I looked at travel videos from Lake Garda and Lake Como and all this kind of stuff. So I got a lot of good sun over the weekend. So that's part of the, plus I've done enough of these. I'm getting good with the lighting. My kids have helped me. And so as far as who I'm reading right now, I really like Mark Greene. He's got a series called The Gray Man. And 1 Minute Out is Mark's latest book. And it just got announced that his first Gray Man novel, this is about a CIA guy hunting a CIA guy who's left the agency under certain circumstances, is being, Netflix bought it, and they're turning it into a movie. I think it's with Ryan Gosling, and I forget, but it was just $200 million budget. It's huge. And so Mark Greene, I think, is a fabulous writer, and that's who I'm reading right now, actually.
How many of your books have been made into films, or how many are still there? And boy, you talk about a Byzantine world, Hollywood. People ask me all the time when you're here in Philadelphia with us, why are these not in a movie theater? Almost every book you've written.
It's not for lack of trying, I'll tell you that
much. I know that.
Dom, I tell people that in L.A., a town filled with so many beautiful people, I have kissed every frog in that town. I have been left at the altar so many times. It's like the Serengeti, and a new executive will come into the film studio, and like a lion coming into the pride, he kills all the cubs. So anything that got developed before that exec was there is out. But we did, before coronavirus, before the lockdowns happened, we actually, this makes every deal that didn't happen for me worth it. We had one of the biggest producers in Hollywood come to us and say, you've got 19 of these Scott Harvath books, plus one called The Athena Project with all of your, with your female Delta Force operators. And he said, this is like buying the Marvel universe. We could go on and on and on and make stuff and just not stop. And I said, wow, that's exciting. He said, who would you like to direct? And I said, you're going to give me a choice? And he goes, yeah. He goes, let me tell you who my three picks would be to direct. And the guy he picked was my top guy. Top guy in his list was my favorite action director. And I said, you can make that happen? He goes, yeah, get him on the phone. What are you doing at 2 o'clock? And turns out this director is a fan of my books, has read the books and everything. So now we're in this great position where we've got this fabulous director, fabulous. I mean, the movies, everybody watching now has seen their movies, these two. They're incredible. Mm-hmm. So now behind the scenes, we're working with the writer and we're putting everything together and then figuring out where we want to place this. Do we want to do something at like a Netflix or do we want to go traditional studio wise? But everything is being put in place so that when coronavirus is gone here, or potentially maybe we shoot it in another country once they've got the all clear. But you got the ducks with lots of movement under the waterline. They're paddling pretty quickly.
Well, I'm so glad for you. Every time we've talked about this, this has been an ongoing thing. Wanted to get an update too. What's the situation now with Scott Harbeth? A lot of your books were Islamic terrorism. Now we're moving to the Russians again. What was the pivot point for you? Did you just tire inspirationally your muse with the Islamic stuff, or was there a pivot point where you see the Russians as a bigger threat right now?
Yeah, so I did something with the Chinese a couple of books ago in Act of War. I need to keep it fresh for me as a mm-hmm. as a writer. If I want my protagonist, like I said, they're like the Bond movies. I want each one to be different, each one to be interesting, each one to be unique. And I didn't want to. Here's particularly what I've seen over the last several years is we've been in Afghanistan and Iraq for so long. We have a very war-weary public, and rightfully so. And so I started thinking, oh boy, particularly after Putin went in and took the Crimean Peninsula. For those of you who are watching this and don't know, when the Soviet Union broke up, about a third of the nuke arsenal was in Ukraine. And we made the Ukrainians a deal. We said, we will protect you. If you get rid of these weapons, allow them to be decommissioned, and don't have nukes, we'll protect you. We'll make sure nobody ever comes and takes any of your territory, anything like this. And they said, okay, will you put that on paper? So we did. And they said, now get the Russians to sign it. The Russians don't care. They signed it anyway. They were in a state of disarray. But then fast forward to Putin taking the Crimean Peninsula. And the only thing basically that happened to the Russians was they got thrown out of the G8. It becomes the G7. And there's some harshly worded letters and this kind of stuff. So I got to thinking as a thriller writer, well, if you're familiar with NATO, there is a charter, that part of the NATO charter, Article 5 says that an attack on one nation in NATO is an attack on all. And I thought, boy, if Putin decided that he wanted, like the Crimean Peninsula, wanted to go into some of the smaller NATO states in the Baltic, well, you know what? How many Americans would want to send their sons and daughters to a place that they can't even pronounce right. or can't even find on a map? So I thought, okay, this would be interesting for a thriller writer to have a president, because my presidents are fictional, to have a president that says, listen, I don't want us to get dragged into war over in Europe. So you, Scott Harbeth, Brad Thor's protagonist, you go do whatever it takes to defang these guys and make sure this doesn't happen. And that's what started me down that path.
Scott, you mentioned, I'm sorry, Brad, you mentioned Scott Harbeth is a spy. I don't know. I don't think of that word with him as much as, I don't know what's the word, but you said spy.
Right. So I have described him as a covert counterterrorism operative and all right. that kind of stuff. So he comes out of the SEAL community. He has that special operations background. He got picked up and mentored by someone who was retired from the CIA that taught him even more stuff than he had learned in the SEALs. So spy is a like polo shirt, right? I'm wearing this, you're wearing that. Neither of these are officially polo shirts. But if somebody said, hey, did you see Dom? I think Dom was wearing a polo shirt like Thor was in that interview. Mm-hmm. It is a term that a lot of people can understand. And technically, spy really isn't, you wouldn't even use that to describe somebody at the CIA. They'd be an intelligence officer. You've got case officers, and it's the spies that they recruit that get them the information. But it's a good term that people can relate to and can understand. I mean, James Bond is always referred to as a spy, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit, it is the as Harvath's career has developed and as his missions have changed, it's the term that feels the most comfortable for me as the writer to apply to him.
All right, we're taking questions for Brad, too. We'd love to hear anything you want for America's favorite thrower writer, Brad Thor. So in this book, too, you introduce another female character. You've had female characters before, but you seem to put this as something new, a breakthrough with this character. So let's talk about the need for a female character, freshen it up with that, someone on Harvath's level as a spy or operative.
So the task that I set for this. So first of all, my readership, Dom, is about 60% male, 40% female.
Wait a minute, I would guess the other way.
Oh, it's 60-40, and that 40% female demographic has been growing with leaps in leaps and bounds. And the female characters in my books are always ways of reflecting back the women that I have around me, both in my personal and professional life, whether it's my wife, my daughter, my editor, mm-hmm. my agent, the vice president at my company. These are all super smart, super talented women. And so the female characters are always strong in my thrillers. And that female character, the key female character in each book, is always critical to Scott Harvath achieving a successful outcome of his mission. So with this book, I said, all right, I'd like to set the bar even higher. Create a character, a female character, who has got all of the darkness that Harvath has, all of the kind of broken past and some of the bad stuff in her past, but that she may even be a step above Harvath in her skill set. And I said, that would be cool, not to have somebody on his level, but maybe even a step above. And so I created this character from the Norwegian intelligence service named Solvi Kolstad. And what's funny is I expected to hear from my female readers, and I have, and they love this female character. But the emails from the guy readers are overwhelming. Oh, she's awesome. You've got to give her her own book. She kicks butt.
Would you consider doing that? Would you consider doing
that? Yeah, I think it'd be a fun thing to do. She's a great character. I love her. And she was just a blast to write. I take pictures of actors and actresses, and right behind me, behind my computer here, is a big wall. And I tape it up, tape the photos up there. And right behind the computer was Solvi Kolstad. Harvath was over here, but the Norwegian intelligence officer, I'd see her every morning. I'd come in, I'd raise my coffee mug to her. You know, she was watching me the whole time to make sure I wrote her well.
Scott, well, how many hours a day? Do you have a discipline schedule? You write X number, or is it when you're on something, you get going and you write until you can't write anymore?
So I forget the author that says that it said this years ago, but it really is seat of pants to seat of chair. It's all about self-discipline. And Jack mm-hmm. London was famous for saying, you can't wait for inspiration. You have to go after it with a club. And that's very much true with me, because I write a book a year. So I have to do my research. I have to do, come up with the idea, do the research, do the writing, do the editing. So there isn't a lot of time to sit around and just wait to get inspired. So before the lockdown, I'd be up in the morning, breakfast with the kids and that kind of stuff. They'd go to school, I'd work out. I'm in the office very early, and I treat it like a 8 to 6 kind of a situation, because I want to be home to have dinner with my family. So some days the words come easier than others. Some days it's like pulling teeth or clumps of hair out. But I don't outline, Dom. I want to have the same experience writing the book that the readers do reading it. You don't know what's going to happen next. I want my palms to sweat and my heart to pound. I paint myself into corners a lot, and I go home and my wife can tell by the look on my face if it's a red wine night or a bourbon night, based on how bad of a situation I've left myself in. But she says, you know what, you'll figure it out tomorrow. You always do. And I do. Robert Frost once said, no joy in the writer, no joy in the reader. No surprise mm-hmm. in the writer, no surprise in the reader. So outlining, I tried to do it with one book, and I hated it, and I threw the whole concept out, because it's just, I came in every day and it was like an instruction manual. Now screw bolt A to bolt B, and it wasn't fun. And
it's too hard of a job. You're very self-disciplined too. You want surprise, you want joy, but you're very self-disciplined at it. That seems to be the combination of a few of the people I've interviewed that are great writers. You need both things.
I think so.
I mean, maybe a book or two if you're Dylan Thomas or someone like that who has a gift and then he dies at 30 as an alcoholic. You know, that's I don't think you have longevity doing that stuff.
No, you certainly don't.
You talk about the characters, Harvath and now this new character too. And you talk about them as if they are somebody that is a human being. Talk about that. I mean, it must be, particularly with Harvath, it must become something like that to you.
Yeah, it does. It's interesting because my wife pointed out, she said, you know, your readers only get to be with Harvath once a year. You mm-hmm. spend all year with him. And I tell people that Harvath is my alter ego, the same way I'm sure Bond was for Ian Fleming and Jack Ryan was for Tom Clancy. I joke that Harvath gets to do the things that my wife won't let me do. So there's a certain amount of living vicariously through the words, deeds, crazy action of Scott Harvath for me. So they do, I think as a writer, not I think, for me, they have to be, it has to be as if they're real. Because when I'm writing, it's playing out across the movie screen of my imagination. I'm really seeing these things as I write these scenes. I'm envisioning them as how they would appear on a movie screen. So these characters have to have personalities, they have to have backgrounds, because all that informs how they're going to speak, how they're going to make certain decisions. So they are, I mean, I'm not nuts. I know they're not real people, but this is about as close as I can get to having to thinking of them as real people.
Scott, the title, I don't know if we've talked before about some of your titles. You added a thriller to this, as if we didn't know Brad Thor, a thriller, right? Mm-hmm. What's the process of coming up with the title? Does a title really help sell a book at your stage now? People are waiting each year. You've developed this idea. We're going to get that book right in the throes of summer.
Well, for me, Dom, I'm still the man that grew up in the Midwest, Marine Corps dad, mom had worked at TWA. I'm a small business person. So mm-hmm. that's how I really look at what I do. And I'm always interested in adding to my customer base. I want people who haven't tried my books before to give it a try. So I treat every single book as if, is this book good enough? Number one, the concept, I start with the concept. Is this book good enough to get me a contract with Simon & Schuster if nobody knew who I was? It's, you can never take those people that have make your career possible for granted. And like I said earlier, the readers are my bosses. So what's funny with Near Dark is we put this together. The title actually came from my editor. This was her title for this book, and it was brilliant because I was giving her titles, and she said, no. And then she hit on this theme of Near Dark because of the darkness in the book and all that kind of stuff. And I thought it was a great title. And what's neat about the book, and a lot of people, you can't tell when you go to an online website, but the book is actually, it's like almost like it's wrapped in a silver, like a mirrored finish.
Right.
So we did something interesting. There's Mont Saint-Michel in the background, which is in the Normandy area of France. This book was designed to grab people's attention in a bookstore. So the title was important. The way we did something we've never done before with the foil kind of a packaging, so title and artwork and all that kind of stuff is important because I always want, as a small business person, to grow my business. So I wanted to entice, you know, you hear the old, you can't judge a book by its cover. Yeah, you actually can to a certain degree. And if it gets people to pick it up, that's half the battle right there. So they pick it up and then you've got to hope that you're the copy, the jacket copy that you wrote, the little thing about this is what the book's about is enough to get them to buy the book. So a lot of thought goes into this stuff. And I say, we're like we, meaning me and my publisher and everything. It's like Apple rolling out a new product every year. We really have to give people, you know, we have to be good with our customer service and we have to give people a great product. And we want to be excited about it because that's contagious. If you're excited about your product, people are going to pick up on that. They're going to get excited too.
I think it's James from Exton, because we're getting so many people with questions, wanted to know, was it easier or harder to write during the quarantine? It would seem to be easier, right?
Well, so this book was pretty much done before the quarantine. So I'm writing next year's book now. It is, my goal for myself is, what do I come out of this quarantine with and as? So do I come out as a better husband, better father, better writer? And do I come out with one book or do I come out with two? And I, 1 year I wrote two books. That year that I did the Athena Project about the all-female Delta Force team, that was the result of doing two books in 1 year. And I always told fans, well, if I just had more time. Well, be careful what you wish for, because guess what? Now I got nothing but time. So if I don't come out with a second product this year, a second book, I'm going to, there's the possibility I'm going to feel like I blew a great opportunity. So it has gotten easier for me because I've learned to put back up. I was constantly, you know, the TV was always on in the background, which is not good and all this kind of stuff. So I had to go back to my old rules of what works when I'm writing. And that's as few distractions as possible. You know, I can get all the news I want over breakfast in the morning, or if I'm in the car, blah, 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 blah. So it's a double-edged sword. A lot of what I do as a writer is interact with other people and see quirks, and, you know, I'll sit in a coffee shop and watch people. That's been removed. So that kind of studying of other human beings is gone. So it's and my radar is a little muddled because we don't know. I've told people I'm not going to include coronavirus in next year's book. You're not going to.
Why not? Come on now, Scott. Can we turn you a little bit here? Why not?
In your hands.
Come on.
I'm selling Escape. I did a pandemic about six books ago. And it's so my book Code of Conduct was all about a global pandemic where I told you before we went on that the opening sentence in that was, if the American president could get the virus, then no one was safe. And that was the first line of my book Code of Conduct. I want to give people escape. I want to give people a break from coronavirus, let them pick up the book and not think about it. Just have a great thrill ride. And I also don't want to write about a world where spies have to be socially distant and try to communicate from behind face masks and stuff. I'm the fun guy. I want to take you away from all this.
All right. I'm getting the question right here. I have to take this home question. My wife wants to know, do you ever take a break, a family vacation, or is he like me? Come on now. Look, I'm tan. He's not. You know, I had to be on vacation.
I took the family with me to Key West last summer.
Dive bars again, yes.
Yeah. It was good to get the kids broken into that culture. That's important. Yeah. All the dollar bills on the wall and all that kind of stuff. So, no, I do try to take breaks. And in fact, that's one of the things I miss the most right now is before I became an author, I was a travel journalist. I had my own travel show on public television. I thought traveling made me a better American, traveling as a young person. So I wanted to encourage more young people to get out and see the world and not wait till they're retired to do it. So the show did very well. It was meant to be 18 to 34 year olds as our core demographic, but we were pulling people into their 80s that were watching it, loving it, sending in fan mail and stuff. So I do take vacations, or I'd like to be taking vacations. I miss that, particularly to other countries. That's something I really enjoy. Last year I was in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, and Switzerland. So I got around a bunch last year. So a good thing stocked up lots of memories.
Some people told me they think this is that really are fans down to the, you know, that I did my research. This is the most emotional Brad Thor book.
I would agree with that. I stepped way outside my comfort zone because part of the challenge of bringing a series character back, the same protagonist back, is you want to reveal a little bit more about him each book. Mm-hmm. And you also want to be able to not bore longtime readers with the stuff you need to put into the book to get a first-time reader up to speed. Like I talked about the James Bond movies, you can jump right in. You're going to learn a little bit about Bond in that movie, but not so much that you're like, yeah, I've seen this in all the other movies. I get it. So that's that delicate balance. But it is emotional, and that is something that I wanted to do, was to kind of, as we talked about before, that theme of darkness in the book.
Let me stop and ask you, though, and I only know you as a friend, and friend being on in the four appearances and all, and, you know, we have pretty good sense. You seem to be as balanced as anybody I've ever interviewed, thousands and thousands of people. So how do you tap into that darkness? Where does it come from? How do you have access to that, Brad? Because Harvath is an extremely indomitable figure, but dark, dark figure at the same time.
Yeah, it's tough. And this is why this book was so difficult to write, because I didn't know, had I shown too much of that, or not enough of that until it was all written and it was turned in. So I had no idea. So it was stressful the entire way because I'm thinking to myself, okay, are we getting too dark here? Is it? But what's interesting is when I put the I've got a sample of, I don't know, I think it's like three chapters. We put it up on my website, a retired friend from the CIA reached out to me and he said, I got to tell you, those first three chapters, he goes, it triggered something in me very dark. And I'm like, really, what are you talking about? And he said, well, that first year after the 9/11 attacks, he said, I basically wasn't home. I was sent and I didn't look back. I spent a year hunting bad guys. And he said, the darkness, I'm getting the hairs standing up on my arms, but he told me this. He said, what you nail in the beginning of the book, he said, I've been there. I've seen it that dark. And I thought, wow, okay. I really somehow tapped into this. I can't say it's anything more than just knowing so many people that have been at this game, chasing the worst of the worst around the world. Dom, you and I have talked about this before. There can be no American dream without those brave men and women willing to protect it. You know, you don't have a successful radio program where you get to speak the truth and enjoy your First Amendment rights. I don't have a career as an author without these people. And it does those constant going away to do dangerous things. It takes its toll eventually. And so I think a little bits of it was just time spent with people that have done a lot of these jobs and listening to their stories. I always joke that I buy a lot of steak dinners and a lot of pitchers of beer and then just shut up. Sure. Because that's where I learned the most.
And for listeners, you told me this, I think maybe not even directly in the interview, but off air and stuff like that. They can't be recognized either, at least in other professions. Yeah. When you're a hero, you're doing this. Yeah. Sacrifice of family is very difficult. Mm-hmm. You can be recognized here. That's the last thing in the world you want to be, is recognized.
Well, there's a reason we call them the quiet professionals. And their families serve too. That's why it's always important to recognize not only the sacrifice and service of the men and women that go do these things, whether it's in the military or the intelligence world or law enforcement, even things that happen in the areas of diplomacy, the families serve too. And so that's really important. So this is where, because I have not hit a bottom like this where, you know, a bunch of people close to me were killed and it was all my fault and I couldn't, you know, I don't shoulder guilt like that, like Harvett does in the book, but I had to try to at least imagine what it would be like for him. And that was the tricky goal. And thankfully I did it in such a way that readers have really responded and love it. So I was worried it might be too dark and people say, nope, just right.
Got a question about who should play Scott Harvath. We always get that in the film when this comes out after the pandemic, yep, after everything else. Who are some, not Ryan Gosling, you mentioned him earlier.
No,
let's
excise
that from
that's
the show.
For Mark
that's
Green,
that's not out. Come on now.
Yeah. Well, so this is the interesting discussion that we're now having in Hollywood, or that we just had recently, is we said, okay, should the star make the movie or should the movie make the star? And the producer, director, and I all agreed that the movie should make the star, much the way Sean Connery was made with the James Bond movies. So we all agreed that we want to take someone who has acted before, but you're not going to have trouble seeing them in this role because you liked them so much better in this thing over here. So I'm not going to grab Chris Hemsworth, who plays Thor in the movies, right, although that'd be kind of funny if Hemsworth. So it's not going to be something like that. It's going to be an actor that this is their really, really big role that's going to launch them to superstardom.
We have a fan, Scott, Brad, that wants to know. Scott, I feel like I'm talking to Scott Harvath. Brad wants to know, do you still write short stories?
No, I did. I'm really not a short story writer. I did one in the early days of the International Thriller Writers Association. We were all asked to contribute one to this anthology that James Patterson was the editor on to help raise money for our guild. And I did one there. It's pretty much the only short story I've ever done, actually. So I guess the answer would be no. I don't.
The comment of the night, Carol likes my tan. I'm just keeping the tan thing going here. This
Smart.
Is not fake. It's
there
not fake news. It's not anything like that. So what is the favorite part of this book for you? If you had to point something out to readers that haven't consumed it yet, what's your favorite part? Was it something where it was very difficult to write? Does that turn you on in the book, or is it something else?
Boy, that's a great question. Every single chat. So I had somebody ask me how much gets cut when you edit.
Yes.
And nothing, unless I've repeated myself. My wife catches that I've repeated myself, that I wrote something that I forgot was back 5 chapters in the book. It's very lean into the bone, and each chapter drives the action forward for the next chapter. So there isn't a lot of fat to cut. So every chapter is like writing a book for me. It's a challenge, and I want to leave you with a cliffhanger at the end of the chapter, so you want to go to the next chapter. But it's a great question. I think one of my favorite things in this book was I got to bring in a couple of characters that were in a previous book, a little bit of an Easter egg. You don't need to have read, again, any of the books before. But one thing is, Scott Harvath has always wanted his own family, and it's been denied to him. And part of that reason is because he always takes these assignments and continues to go off on these dangerous missions. He will not come out of the field. It's almost selfish. He doesn't believe anybody else can do it as well as he can, and it creates problems for him.
But where does that come from? Where did you get that concept from the guys that you're around? How did you come to that feeling? That's what it's about.
So there is a saying around some of these guys, which is you never want to be a former action guy, that you can actually get addicted to the lifestyle. And so what you find with a lot of these guys is that after they've been in it for a while, they've got injuries and things like this, like professional athletes. But there is no rule book that says they can't do steroids, they can't do performance-enhancing drugs. They can go out and do all that kind of stuff. And
which is a big part, or at least Roe and I, my wife, saw this in this book with Harvath, and you and I have talked about that.
I know more than a few people that have done it. So that's an interesting thing too. Again, this is what I try to do with my thrillers, is allow you to kind of peek behind the curtain and really see deep into this world and make it as exciting as possible at the same time, to not have it read like a training manual, but you get these little things along the way. So for Harvath, to answer that last question, there is a character in there who's now being faced with, he thinks his girlfriend is pregnant, and he doesn't know if he wants this. And Harvath is, so it's Nicholas, the troll character, who's got primordial dwarfism, and he's worried, what if the baby ends up like me? What if the baby ends up as a little person? My life has been hell because of my size.
Why did that come to you? Where did you get that from?
I thought it was, the muse gave it to me. I thought it was an interesting juxtaposition that here Harvath, partly because of his own behavior, has been denied the one thing he claims he wants the most out of life. Now he's got this friend who is basically having a family handed to him on a silver platter, and his friend doesn't want it. And he's worried about, will the baby be healthy and all this kind of stuff. And I thought it was an interesting way to explore what Harvath has alleged he's always wanted, and what the fans have always wanted for him too. They've always wanted him to have a great partner. They've hoped that one or more than one of these women that have come along in the books would be the one for him. And so that's kind of the fun to play with all that in Near Dark.
The thing that excites me the most, I want to go back to when you had that idea that you didn't share with anyone else in true CIA fashion about the $100 million bounty, and then you still go on the offensive. You must have been around guys enough that they say stuff like that, what they would do or how they think. I'd love to be there in a room and hear that. You feel like you want to run through a wall. A guy that says, oh yeah, you put the bounty on my head, that means I'm coming after you even more out of self-preservation, but also because that's what I do.
Yeah, that's how I'm wired. I've always said that Harvath is an apex predator. He's the top of the food chain. There is nobody better. There's no predator that preys on him. He's at the top. He's the apex predator. So in that, the fact that I hadn't made that connection, I wasn't thinking like Harvath. I was thinking like an author going, okay, what am I going to do? And the biggest problem for me, Dom, with this book was Harvath is so skilled and so well-trained that if he throws his cell phone into the ocean, you're never going to find him. There's no way. Assassins, $100 million bounty, big deal. If he throws his phone away, unless he's telling somebody his whereabouts and they're revealing it to the assassins, you're never going to find him. And that was a real hard part of getting this book started, until I talked to that colleague who said, no, Harvest, not a mouse. the cat thing, and he's gonna go after these people. You don't turn him into a mouse. He's always the cat. He always turns it around.
And that did it. That turned the book around. I don't think I've ever asked you, of course, the United States, of course, you know these guys, you honor them by doing this, second to none, because we know pop culture is what pushes ideas forward more than politics.
Politics is downstream of culture. Yes.
Exactly. What's the second best intelligence, outfit, covert action group in the world? Who do you like?
Well, I got to tell you, as far as ability to keep secrets, carry out incredibly difficult mm-hmm. missions, gather the Israelis are fantastic. I mean, they are really, really good. And I mean, they've made some mistakes and things like this, but they don't ever feel the need to crow about it, which I think is very, very interesting. So, I put the Israelis way up there.
Russians in this book, that's, again, are they overrated? You see, there's a lot of crashes and a lot of escaping from the Russians. They don't seem to be, I'm stereotyping, they don't
they're
seem
not
to
that
be
sophisticated
or
no,
inventive. They're not. yeah
and their stuff always gets unraveled in the end. The Russians were hiding a wet work team in France, just over the, in real life, just over the border with Switzerland, and they screwed everything up because they were carrying their cell phones with them when they were going to do surveillance, so you knew what Wi-Fi routers they were pinging off of and all this kind of stuff. They're very ham-fisted. I talk about in the book that they may have, and this is an overly generous compliment, may have had a somewhat decent capability at one point, long time ago, but now it's gone from playing chess, and a lot of people would argue they were never good chess players in the intelligence realm, to playing checkers, and not even checkers. It's just, they're not that good. So I wouldn't put the Russians up there. I mean, they're a bunch of thugs, and it's, you know, it's like the Sopranos, basically. You know, the Sopranos can plan a hit and carry it out, but it's always very loud and very messy.
Well, when they put plutonium in your cereal, you know, that's the type of thing you got to expect from them, right? That's what I see as Putin, just pure evil right there in front of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I had always said that as the Soviet Union was collapsing and they were no longer a world power, they were going to get more dangerous. Because they were going to be more desperate for prominence. And you see this with Putin. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff they've done. The downing of the jetliner by their guys in Ukraine. I mean, this is, you know, submarines that crash and just all this kind of stuff. I mean, Chernobyl. I wish I had more episodes of Chernobyl to watch. It was such a good series. And it just shows you the Russians have been screwed up forever.
I agree. Yeah, I'd love to sit there with you when you're seeing the scene when the guy comes in and smooths everything over. They kind of rally. He tells them this is the way we do things with the world collapsing around them. And I buy that's exactly what they would do.
Yeah.
Had a question. Is there a character in a situation, a character looking back? I don't know if you look back years later. The listener wanted to know. And you think, I could have done better here. I should have put it this way or had a different outcome. Is there anything? You have any regrets about something looking back on it now that you're a more mature writer, you know, something else that you could have done better with?
Yeah, the one thing I love about being an author, Dom, is that I really do believe it is a craft that you can get better at. Mm-hmm. I spend a tremendous amount of time between books, reading books on writing still. I've written 20 novels and I still read books about the writing process because I want to get better. So I don't look back. I asked the late Vince Flynn that question too at one point, who wrote the fantastic Mitch Rapp novels. You know, would you go back? Would you change anything? And he said, listen, it's just the nature of the beast. You'd always go back and find stuff you could change and do differently and all that kind of stuff. Would it make the book any better? Probably not. And so for me, I don't look back because I'm always so busy working on next year's book that there really is no time for that. But I do, so I'm coming up on the anniversary in 2 years, less than 2 years now. So in January 2022, it'll be 20 years since The Lions of Lucerne, my first thriller, mm-hmm. was published. And I do wonder, is there something I can do with that? You know, what would I do that'd make that special? Would I go back in and change it? I don't know. But that's about the only going back thing I think about. Would I refresh the technology in it? Oh.
We had a question too. How many books in the pipeline at any one point?
So one at a time. I may have ideas for going forward books wise, but I spend a lot of time. I'm a voracious consumer of news, geopolitics, and things like this. So I'm always trying. I want my books, doesn't matter if you get the first one or the most recent one, they feel evergreen. So it's like I never wrote about bin Laden because I knew eventually they would kill or capture bin Laden. It's the same reason I'm not going to write about COVID because, God willing, we're going to get a vaccine. Mm-hmm. It's going to eventually burn itself out, blah, 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 that kind of a thing. And it'll be gone and no longer a problem. So each book, you can pick up any book and it'll still feel fresh. That's the big challenge for me. So I'm always kind of looking at what's happening now and how do I turn what's happening now into a story so that it has that resonance when the book comes out next year. A lot of times things happen that I'll write a book and then all of a sudden something I've written about happens in the real world. And that's, you know, a certain amount of research, it's a certain amount of good luck. When they traded the Taliban prisoners for Bo Bergdahl, who had wandered away in Afghanistan, I had opened up one of my thrillers called The First Commandment with five prisoners from Gitmo being released, the same amount that had been released for Bo Bergdahl. I could have said four, I could have said six, I said five. I got lucky. You know, there was no way I could have known that we would ever trade prisoners away for an American who went AWOL, but we did, and it just so happened I lucked out with the five.
I asked this of everybody, O'Reilly, friends with, and I asked him, and he gives it up. I don't know if you will. I think he's done his Killing series, which is just a great concept. Which one is your favorite? And I always put in my vote, despite loving every one of them. Is there a favorite book still, or is it you haven't written that yet?
Of mine?
Yes.
Of my thrillers? Well, you know, it's going to sound like a prepared answer, and it is to a certain degree because I've been asked this question before. So I always tell people my favorite is the next one because that's the one I'm passionate about. That's the one I'm working on right now. So it's next year's book is my current. That's that whole I don't give away the idea because that takes gas out of the tank. So right now, I'm super passionate about this book. I'm super excited about it because that's the energy that gets me through the year of writing the book. So again, it sounds like a little bit of a canned answer, but it's really true. I am most excited and love most the next book. I will tell you this though, finishing my very first novel, The Lions of Lucerne, because my wife had asked me on our honeymoon, what would you regret on your deathbed never having done? And I said, writing a book and getting it published. And she said, okay, that's when I was back in TV. And she said, when we get home from this honeymoon, you need to start taking 2 hours a day to make that happen. So finishing that book, I felt fantastic. I thought this must be what people feel like when they run their first marathon or climb their first mountain. I would never be on my deathbed wondering what my life might have been like had I just tried to write the book. And I also knew, Dom, that I could do it again. I knew, I had that feeling, okay, I've now completed a novel. I've cracked this. I could write more. And so that's a little bit of the experience.
Well, your wife, I don't know if she's the muse or the tough love drill sergeant there. What's your muse though? What is it where, when you're working out, I know you're a fitness fanatic. Is that where ideas come because your mind's occupied by that and the subconscious comes in? Is that the muse?
That's a great, so that is part of it. That's where I particularly when I'm running, that is where I get into a zone and I can lose all track of time in those corners I've painted myself into currently writing a book. A lot of that works out when I'm exercising. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the shop floor, if you will, the factory floor, and that stuff gets worked out. The muse though, when people say, where do you get your ideas from? I say in the shower or after the second glass of wine, because that's when I'm most relaxed. I get a lot of ideas when I watch really well-written television, believe it or not. I'm a huge fan of Ray Donovan, the series on Showtime. I think that's great. I love the writing. So if there's good writing, sometimes that can percolate some ideas, but it is when I'm just mellowed out, my brain is shut down or shut off. I'm not thinking about work that the muse pops up and these things happen.
What's your wine recommendation? What do you recommend that is the most muse-like?
Oh, so my wife is a big white wine drinker, and she likes basically the Chablis, which is just Chardonnay that doesn't go into oak barrels. So, but you know, we're shopping at the grocery store now because we can do the whole touchless delivery. So I'm kind of at the mercy of what the grocery store. We're doing a lot of Pinot Grigio this summer, but I'm going to live in Tennessee. I love my bourbon too. So I'm a big bourbon guy as well.
Well, you are just an unbelievable writer and person. I mean, you're a dream as an interview. So you know that.
Oh, thank you.
You put forward and it's genuine. So I can wish nothing but success. And I think the deep thing too is you honor these people that no one else even knows who they are. And that is very, very hard to do. So thank you. I just wish there were two books a year, but then it would be diluted. Then it wouldn't be that we have an opportunity. Hopefully next year it'll be in person in the Philadelphia area again.
I would love to be back in Philly. And we've had so much fun together. And I want to thank you for just sharing me with your audience. I've had more people say they've heard about my books because of you, Dom. And that word of mouth is the greatest thing you can do for an author you like. You say to somebody, try this book. I've had more people say, you know, heard it from Dom. I gave it to my dad. My dad wasn't a reader. Now you've reignited his love of reading. So thank you. And I say, well, thank Dom, because he's the one that told you about it. So I really appreciate that. Thank you, Brad.
Thanks so much. Stay well, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, bye.
Brad Thor, everyone, here as we continue with what is our joy, the virtual speaker series. Thanks to Malma Law. Thanks to Spike Eskin for quarterbacking. Thanks to Greg Stocker. Thanks to Roe here on the home front for scribbling.
Who loves
Brad Thor for a lot of things, scribbling on pads, etc. Thank you all. And of course, thanks to the big guy, Big Dan. Producer Dan Borowski, and Bill, too. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy the rest of the night. We'll talk about some more of this tomorrow with the great Brad Thor. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks a lot, Dom.
Dom Giordano, weekdays 9 till noon on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.